Okay, thanks. Thank you for coming. I do have to thank Deanna. In the dedication, it actually says that when she met me, I was a grad student, and now, many years later, I'm still a grad student. I'm going to show you today is actually research that got too big for a dissertation. And so the dissertation is still to be done, but they want a very short work. And this is a very large work. There's a lot of history in it, we're trying to, in effect, advance the ideas behind innovation. I'm going to give a shout out to Selena Lorette up here, who is the artist, an OCAD graduate. And you have to pause and take a look at the cover. The cover we've called Escaping from Plato's Cave. People know the story of Plato's Cave? Yeah? You want to tell me what it is, Chris?
So, it was a way of explaining philosophy to non-philosophers. Did you want me to go through the whole explanation of what the cave is about?
Yeah, go ahead.
it was called Plato's Allegory of the Cave, and it was designed to express the frustration that one can have when trying to explain new concepts to people who have been exposed to them. So imagine, if you will, you are in a cave and you are chained with fellow prisoners. That's your lot in life. And all you can see as you face the back of the cave, behind you there are torches. And they cast shadows on the wall. And for you, that's your interpretation of reality with your fellow prisoners. One day, after watching a lot of this happen, there would be people passing through the back of the cave and just seeing shadows. You managed to break free. You escape the cave, probably through a door a little less fancy than that. You go outside, and at first you're blinded by the light. It's so harsh on your eyes. You've never seen this before. But suddenly, as you stagger, images become crystal clear. You're able to perceive towns and villages and people conducting commerce and interacting with each other. This is mind-blowing to you. So you go back to the cave, and you try to express this newfound world to your fellow prisoners. And the way that I was taught the allegory of the cave in my undergrad days was, and then you were beaten to death by the fellow prisoners. The end. And so that's how Plato would warn his students, his aspiring students, here's the lot in life that you have ahead of you.
And this is what it's like to be a graduate student at the end of your career rather than at the beginning of your career. So let me take us through the program a little bit. We've been through the introductions. I'll give an outline of the book. And then Tim and Stephen will come up and have some commentary just on what they heard and what they think about it. Peter will moderate the Q&A. And it's interesting having a book launching when we actually discourage people from ordering the book. It's available for free in download, and it's actually better to read in download. We have a physical copy of the book here, and once you look at it, you go, yeah, maybe I don't want to take something that large, and maybe I'll save a few trees and do it electronically. But I have postcards, and if you really want a souvenir, I'll sign a postcard for you. So I'm going to talk about this in five parts. Firstly, the title Open Innovation Learning is something that came towards the end of writing this. And in effect, I've been writing this book pretty steadily since 2014. So at the end of 2016 and beginning of 2017, when I was working on it, I actually rewrote the last chapter, chapter 9. And in that is when I started writing about open innovation learning. There's two ways of thinking about open innovation learning. One is open innovation and learning. And the second one is about innovation learning that is open. And I'll go through some of the history for people who aren't familiar with those bodies of work. I'm going to skip over part C for time, descriptive theory building, because most people who are practical want to know what you can do with the theory, and that's what the normative theory building is about. Finally, as I promised, because it's a System Thinking Ontario meeting, I'm going to do a little bit of discussion about open innovation learning and how it relates to system thinking. So Open Innovation was a book that was published in 2003. Henry Chesbrough is at University of California, Berkeley. And he wrote this book, and in effect, the question was, what's happening in the computer industry? In particular, he was saying that Xerox PARC, the Palo Alto Research Center, where things like the bitmap screen and the mouse were first used, and if you believe the stories, Steve Jobs went there, saw it, and then in effect took the technology and created the Mac. That's the downfall of Xerox PARC. And so he said this is not a model to follow, where there's an idea of what he called a closed innovation paradigm. What he observed was that there's an open innovation paradigm, and the companies he studied mostly were IBM, Intel, and Lucent. And this is in 2003, and so the period that I'm looking at IBM and doing the research in is between 2001 and 2011. He would have been there at the beginning, and actually the cases he's talking about are early, and so this actually predates the content that I'm studying. But in essence, in the beginning, IBM was one of the cases cited for open innovation. So what do we mean by open innovation? So we have this closed innovation paradigm, and you see this diamond. And going around the diamond, in effect, you start off with investing in technology, you create products and services, out of that you get revenue, and then that allows you to reinvest. And so the idea of having R&D inside your company was you develop products by yourself and you go around the cycle. And with that, towards lower right, you get the idea of the funnel that you normally see, which you start off with all these innovative ideas, and some of them make it and some of them don't, they get narrowed down. But what happened in the case of Xerox PARC and other ones who followed the closed innovation approach is that things get in the way. Other technologies come in, you get outdated, you get out of step, and the idea that you could actually put money into research start breaking down. So if you don't have sales and you don't have new products and you don't have research, then what do you do? Now the alternative to doing that is what Chesbrough calls open innovation. There's a dotted line which he has that's the boundary of the firm. And essentially the idea was that you could see ideas flowing inside and outside the market and into the company. So this means, pretty simple idea, that if you are a product development company, you don't need to use all the research that's just from your company. You can use research from outside. And also it means that you don't have to use all the technology that you created internally. You could also sell your technology and license your technology. So the focus on that gets around the idea of copyright. So there's been a lot of discussion around intellectual property law, but let me just explain the simplest shift. We start in 1886. This could be a fast trip from 1886. But people are not really, haven't thought about how pervasive copyright is. If you actually look on your character set in old typewriters, copyright was a symbol on the old typewriters. It's that old. But essentially the idea is that when someone takes something and writes it down, and they make a copy of it, when they create an original work, in order for another person to reuse that work, you need their permission. And so I write a book, and I say, oh, okay, if you want to copy this book, then you need my permission to do so. And this is the way that law has gone internationally. Now, it turns out the copyright law is actually a national issue, but there are treaties. And by 1886, that's when they started doing all the negotiations, saying we're going to recognize copyright. So if it's copyrighted in the UK, it's recognized in Germany, it's recognized in the United States, it's copyrighted in Canada, it's recognized in South Africa, all these countries say, okay, copyright is great. And this creates a lot of issues when you get into the new technology of the internet, because the internet didn't exist in 1886. So there was a group that created what was called open source software. They had the Open Software Initiative and created the open source definition, which said, look, if we're going to move faster in the world of software development, we need to get rid of this copyright issue, because what copyright literally says is any time, we'll take a digital photo of a photograph as an example, any photograph that we take today in this room, if you want to use it, it's on the internet, you have to go ask the person that took the photograph, which is ridiculous when you stop and think about how many photographs are on the web today. But that is the law. In order for you to reproduce that photograph, you have to go hunt that person down. So open source said, look, okay, we can move into the software world, And the software world is not just about what we call the object code, it is a source code. It is what you use to generate the code. So it could be C, or it could be name your favorite programming language, JavaScript, Java, whatever it is. They thought that you should be able to have that available because software can be rewritten. So if there's a bug in the software, you want people to come and be able to fix it. And the way that you get things moving faster is to have more people looking at the software and looking at the internals of that. Now, coming along after that in 2002, as a result of this shift, is Creative Commons. Now, you see at the bottom right here, I have a Creative Commons license. And what this says is that I'm going to tell you right up front now, you can copy my work, and this is a by NCSA. So when you copy my work, you don't have to call me. Just say it's by David Ng, this is where I got it from. Non-commercial means that you can't sell it. If you want to come and negotiate with me about selling my book, then I'll do that. Probably won't charge you much if it's free everywhere else. But the motive is there. It's like, if you're going to make money off it, then I might be interested in talking to you about it. There's also a share-like clause associated with this, which is if you make a copy of it, whoever now takes the copy from you and wants to make another copy, they have to share the same privileges and same rights. And so on the book cover that we saw, this was an interesting process as we were working with Selena on it. We went to Flickr and we found photographs, and they were they had the by, and so all we have to do to use that photograph on the cover is say, this is where I got it from. However, one of the three, the image that we have of Plato's cave is actually a composite of three photographs. One of the three photographs has a SA on it, a share alike, which means that in order to be compliant with the law, Selena had to publish the Plato's cave photograph so that someone else can reuse it as well, because that is the law and that's the rules. So what we're doing in this world is trying to accelerate innovation. In 2006, Henry Chesbrough comes and writes another book, because open innovation is a big bestseller, and he creates this second book called Open Business Models. At this point, it's about open source software, because he hadn't thought about the case. When he wrote the first book, he said, this book is about licensing, and so you do all this research, you're not using it, okay, you could go and actually sell it and make money on licensed technology. But what he wrote, found in the book in 2006 is, there's an open source community out there, and what they do is that they have the software code, and anyone can download it, and it's free. Now, what's going on here? What's with this business model? So, back in 1995, Bill Joy, who was one of the founders of Sun Microsystems, had this saying, the smartest people in the world don't work for us, that being Sun Microsystems. Most of them work for someone else. The trick is to make it worthwhile for the great people outside your company to support your technology, and innovation moves faster when the people elsewhere are working on the problem with you. So this has become fairly well known. Joy's law is the smartest people are always working for someone else. Okay, if the smartest people are always working for someone else, then how is it that you actually get them working for you or with you? So open sourcing, as I define it, is a behavior. It is not about the legalities of open sourcing. Open sourcing is a norm where the resources of the system internals, which is the source code or how something gets constructed, all the artifacts and practices are shared in the community beyond the originators. And the metaphor, the simile we use in this is like capturing wild fish. And so we can talk about salmon. You know, the salmon go up and down the stream, and it's kind of free, and if you want to go get salmon, you know, you go at the right time of the year, the salmon are coming by, and you just pick it up. That's one way of getting fish. There's other ways of getting fish. So I have what's called private sourcing, and when Chesbrough talks about open, he talks about closed, and it's a closed paradigm. I wanted to look at it in terms of open and private because I'm interested in the system internals. I'm interested, are you able to recreate something in the innovation? And so private sourcing is coined as a norm where the resources of systems internal are reserved within a privileged group. And so the privileged group could be a company that owns the technology. It could be someone that's licensed it. And you get into the questions about trade secrets. In the book, I cite about the 11 herbs and spices that are in Kentucky Fried Chicken. And that is considered a trade secret. Well, you know, you could probably figure it out by yourself if you work on it long enough, but it is a trade secret. They don't have it published anywhere, and so that is what I would call private sourcing. Patents also tend to fall under this protection that if someone comes and copies a design, then it's patented and it's private sourced and you have to license it. So in this simile, we could talk about aqua farming. In an aqua farming, I don't know if you've been to British Columbia and you've gone to the salmon farms up in the Lynn Valley, or been to a salmon farm. But in effect, they control the water, they control the feed, they control everything. And so we have farmed salmon. Farmed salmon is a private sourcing approach to the world. It says that, you know, we'll manage everything and we'll make money off it because they're for profit. So the third idea that came out of this was the behavior I'm looking at, that you can get switching. So you could go from open sourcing and you could enclose that to private sourcing. So there are licenses in open source that say, okay, you want to private source it? Like you want to take this code and just do whatever you want with it? They have those licenses. So you can actually take code that is on the internet for free and sell it. As a matter of fact, even if it is licensed in the Free Software Foundation, you can actually always sell it. So anyone that wants to go and take LibreOffice and put on a CD-ROM or DVD and sell it on eBay, you'll find people doing that. They sell LibreOffice and OpenOffice on a CD on eBay. And you kind of go, well, you can download it for free. Well, you can, but a lot of people don't. They want the CD or the DVD. Okay, well, you can do that. So you also get going the other direction, which is from private sourcing disclosing to open sourcing, because if an IBM has done this where they grant software, they say, look, you know, it's not good for us to own this patent, so we'll just grant it and you guys can do whatever you want with it. The interesting case that I looked at was open sourcing while private sourcing. And this has been at the core of IBM's strategy and a few other companies, but IBM's been the ones really leading it. If you want an up-to-date example that's not in the book but is pretty common, is Android. So if you have an Android phone, the software on it is free software. You can take it, you can download it. As a matter of fact, you can even sell Android if you wanted to do that, because Google has open-sourced that. And they're doing it open-sourcing while private-sourcing, because they have their own versions for something that they need. And some of the accusations that are made in the early days of Android was, oh, Google's holding back all the good stuff, and they won't let us on the latest release. Well, if you like software that crashes, you might want to keep some of that private until it gets to a point where you can actually make it mature enough that you want to open it up. So there's this art of taking something that is free and selling it, making money off it. And so for those of you who had IBM stock between the period of 2001 to 2011 and saw this huge rise, all of that was based off IBM doing open sourcing while private sourcing, because they did both. Now, inside the book, there are seven cases, and these are in detail, and this is the 400-page appendix that comes with it, with all the history. And these are technologies IBM had done with it. So firstly, integrated development environments. This was the Eclipse project, and then IBM had the rational tools associated with it. You can still go to eclipse.org, you can download versions of the basic software, and then IBM built most of their products on top of it. We have microblogging, which is actually, in effect, Twitter. So IBM was doing research in Twitter, and it had started working off in private sourcing stuff internally, and it had its own version of Twitter, microblogging, and didn't know what to do with it. Is this going to take off? Like, is Twitter going to take off? And they were doing it for a long time because they didn't understand what it was going to do. Number three, blogging. There's a really interesting story about blogging at IBM. John Patrick, one of the vice presidents, came to a meeting and asked these executives and said, oh, this new trend called blogging, you guys know what it is? And they said, no. They came back to IBM. Do you guys know what blogging is? They go, no. It's like, well, why don't we try it? And so what they did when they tried it was that they went and they got open source software. Because it turns out that there's a Nokia employee in Finland who was writing on his spare time, and he was written in Java. And so they took the software and they used it inside of IBM, and they contributed back to the community, and then eventually developed a product out of it. Wikiing. If you don't know what a wiki is, do you actually want to spend money on it? Well, again, IBM went out and got open source software and started with the wiki, and then after a while, it's like, okay, well, we think we know what it is now. We can actually develop a product on it. It's pretty interesting. If those of you who are into history of science really look into it, in the blogging case, there's a really interesting in the wiki case. There's interesting interchange that I put in the appendices, which is, okay, so we're going to have a wiki at IBM. It's available to everyone, all 400,000 employees. And it's kind of like, okay, what do we do with it? Now, this is going back and forth on the forums. And people say, what are we doing with this? It's like, I don't know. Go ahead, try it out. Okay, and they tried it out. How do you delete a page off a wiki? I don't know. Are you supposed to delete a page off a wiki? Well, what's going to delete me in the wiki, and then we'll delete the pages that say delete me? And you can see that IBM is learning because they don't know what a wiki is. And so, you know, just getting the people with their head wrapped around it, it takes a while for these ideas to come together. Number five, podcasting. Now, there's interesting technology inside of IBM where they had podcasting, and it never developed into a product, really, because... It was used a lot internally. So when I was working at IBM, we'd have a team meeting, and they would upload the presentation and the audio. So if you're driving around, you could listen to the presentations when you're moving. But it's not exactly IBM's market, and then it didn't take off. So they still don't have a product that's done that. Number six, mashing up. Mashup technologies. There's a really interesting case in mashups. They went to mashup camps, they created these new technologies in partnership with other companies. But this is actually an interesting case of how you can do everything right and still fail. Because that happened, and there's this point that happens in 2008, 2009 when there's this crash in the market, and that's when all the products came out. So the mashup didn't really happen. This last one, but after I was writing this, I originally had selected 10 cases, and I got to the point where it's like, oh, I'm getting tired of writing these cases, and I asked my friend David Hawk, how many cases do people usually write in their thesis? And he says, two or three, and he said, oh, okay,
yeah.
I'll finish up number seven, and then I'll just move on. And then number seven turned out to be the one that was the longest, which is co-authoring. And this starts off, in effect, in the world of Microsoft Word, and the idea that we would actually do what people do today in Google Docs. Like you go online and like multiple people editing at the same time. In the technologies that we had, there was a lot going on in the open source communities, and IBM got involved with it. And then the LibreOffice, the OpenOffice technology became standardized, went through the open standards practices and got accepted. And then Microsoft decided they wanted to be playing in this world too. So I think the specification for OpenOffice, the specification is about 200 pages. The specification for Microsoft is 5,000 pages. They actually completed the specification in 2008. And how long did it take Microsoft to meet their own specification? 2013. So there's a real convolution in the ISO and standards, and IBM nearly dropped out of the ISO and some of the standards organizations because of this. So there's a lot going on at that time. So this is the background of open sourcing while private sourcing. Essentially, the idea is you can take technology that's free, you can sell it, why not? And this continues today with IBM's technologies. So I'm going to skip now to the innovation learning part. Organizational learning, for people that are not familiar with this literature, really had this turn in 1991. And organizational learning in this one organization science journal had two key ideas. One was the idea about innovation as exploration and exploitation. Now, some of you may have heard about the ambidextrous company or ambidextrous business, but what happens is that, in effect, when you're doing innovation, you have to be ambidextrous. You have to manage the business at hand today and get to manage tomorrow's business at the same time. So innovation is a balance between the two. This eventually gets published by Clayton Christensen in some of his work on Innovator's Dilemma, where you have the customers today, you have the customers tomorrow, and you're trying to trade off the cannibalization between the two. The other one that comes up is communities of practice. In 1991, this is actually the first paper on communities of practice, and the idea that organizations would learn in this way and start a whole body of research. So, for those of you now, there's perspective here, and I warned people. My youngest son Ryan in 1993, he was born. And so the reason I'm actually kind of going back now is that people, I was lecturing in China, and I was talking about IBM, and this was a high school, and one of the high school students came up and asked me about what IBM was. So for people younger, actually, Ryan gave me the right answer after listening years of this. He finally said, IBM is the Google of the baby boomer generation. So that's one way of expressing it. But most people don't appreciate what happened in 1993 and 1992, which was IBM was in big, big trouble. And so Lou Gerstner came in, but he did an $8.9 billion restructuring charge in the second quarter. $8.9 billion to restructure IBM. That's how serious it was. And so there was this problem. So you see the number of employees that they had 300,000 employees in 1992, and in 1993 they're projected to go 255. Actually, I think it went lower than that. I think it went to 240,000 because they gave people so many retirement bonuses and people took them. But if you were there at IBM, because I joined IBM in 1985, I got into the company, had a few years, and then we saw this interesting phenomenon of the slide. So people have been complaining about the IBM stock and don't like, have been watching Warren Buffett as he's been unloading his IBM stock. We've been there before. We've seen it before. IBM is a technology company. It goes through these phases, and we've seen it before. So in 1993, Gerstner came in, and what Gerstner found, and this is written in his book, Who Says Elephants Can't Dance, he found 300,000 IBMers hiding assets owned by internal units. And so he actually said, and this is one of the things that Gerstner actually did for IBM, is you had, for example, you have the hardware people and the software people, and it's like, okay, well, you know, hardware people are trying to sell something, and so they say, okay, we're going to charge the software people this amount of money on transfer pricing. And there's all these little battles inside of IBM because they have all these different products. And Gerstner said, you guys don't own this. This is a company asset. So we'll worry about the pricing later. Worry about the customer. Don't worry about all the internal transfer pricing. So open sourcing was important not just for the marketplace. Open sourcing was very important inside of IBM because if you were inside of IBM, you had access to the whole company. Now, in my career, I took full advantage of this, and Stephen mentioned that I was working, I'm still working on with Jim Sporer, who's in Almaden Research in San Jose. No one told me that I couldn't send an email and make friends with the director of worldwide university relations at IBM. It's like, it's that sort of a company. So if you take it to its maximum, if you have the resources of the whole corporation available to you, that's an open sourcing approach. So in 1993, there was this famous meeting called the Chantilly Meeting. And what Gerstner said, he had 200 customer executives saying with them, and said he would, the second column there, is he said they would work on open, distributed, and user-based solutions. IBM had to get easier to work with, they had multiple product lines, but what he said was that IBM needed to move towards open sourcing. In 1998, I'm jumping ahead, IBM funded the Apache Foundation. So IBM, this is at the beginning of the internet, we're talking about web servers, the machines that serve your pages on the internet. If you go back to 1998, the Apache server was developed and it was taking over 60% of the market at that point. IBM was looking at their products, which were mainly Lotus products, and going, our products are terrible. They're doing actually better in the open source community. And so they went to the Apache Foundation, these developers that were writing this Apache server, and they created a not-for-profit foundation to own that software. And in doing so, it's interesting that this is a case, so of those of you who've seen, who've read the book The World is Flat by Thomas Friedman, this is Flattener number 4, which is a story about IBM going to Apache and taking open source software for the first time. You've got Microsoft at this point going, what are these guys, crazy? You would go out and you would take software that you could get for free, and you're going to support open source project, and then secondly, you're going to sell something that someone could get for free. Well, it turns out that the WebSphere brand that came out of this was probably the number one revenue generator for the decade of IBM, because IBM would take the internet technologies like the web server, the Apache server, and they were selling it. But there's more to the software than just the software. There's the services. So if you're working at one of these banks on Bay Street and your server goes down, you don't go to an open source community to get it fixed. You want IBM to come and fix it, and you want it fixed right now, and they're willing to pay for it. So there's a case where understanding your customers and saying, well, some people will pay for some things, other people won't pay for it, is a way of making money. In the 2001 annual report, there were 16 decisions that transformed IBM, and this is the handover from Lou Gerstner to Sam Palmisano. And this is a really interesting turn, because Gerstner is credited for turning IBM around. He got IBM out of trouble and financially stable. But by 2001, there's a really interesting problem at IBM. Now they're financially stable, how do you grow? And so the research I've done has been in the decade, in effect the Palmisano years, starting at 2001, and the premise in the 2001, and if you look at the 2002, the 2003, 2004 annual reports, IBM's strategy is open. And if it continues today, you could go look in the annual report today, and it's still open. Here's one of the big things that made the news. So in 2001, IBM invested $1 billion in Linux. Now, IBM has 4 operating systems at that point. They're running on different platforms. And they come out and they go, okay, we'll run Linux on all our machines. So it doesn't matter what the hardware is. It could be a mainframe. It could be a mini computer, it could be a PC, we don't care, we'll do this. And so this is the ultimate free software license, and IBM is contributing to this and continues to contribute to this. So last year, IBM said they're committing another $1 billion to Linux. And you ask, why would they do that? If you actually look at what's happened inside of IBM in the last three years, IBM has not only open sourced the software, they're open sourcing the hardware designs for the PowerPC chips. Who is building the PowerPC chips? They seem to be all Chinese manufacturers. So 3 years ago, there was a discussion in the US Congress about, wait a minute, is Intel going to be in trouble? Because IBM is open sourcing the design of chips for free, and the Chinese are actually taking that and they're building chips. And the Chinese are really good at manufacturing cheap, right? So this is the beginning in 2001 when IBM started and Linux got invented, got invested. Taking around 2001, flipping over to the organizational side, organizational learning. In 2001, IBM Systems Journal, there was articles on communities of practice and on knowledge management. So at this point, IBM is learning about innovation. How is it that innovation actually works? Because most people assume you declare innovation, or you read the book, Open Innovation, you kind of go at it. But IBM takes a long time to try to figure out how this stuff works. In 2006, they have the Global Innovation Outlook. The Global Innovation Outlook explored the nature of innovation. And what they found is that in the 21st century, the nature of innovation is increasingly open, collaborative, multidisciplinary, and global. So if you're at IBM and you're working there, I said this is the mantra you're supposed to learn in 2006. This is what innovation is all about. So we've been talking about innovation. Well, what does that really mean? Well, let's look at the juxtaposition and infer it. So we go to the industrial age. The strategy used to be private. So you'd have methods in development, that will give you an autonomous control over design. You own the design. And now the strategy is to have standards and interfaces leveraging expedient platforms for advancing design. You want the code that works. You want to have it out in the marketplace. So for those of you, how many people know about GitHub? Oh, okay, that's a good number of people know about GitHub. So GitHub has become a community. Oh, so here's the skill testing question. Linux was invented by who? What was his number two invention? Linus Torvalds' number two invention was what? Git. Is the technology behind GitHub. So the idea was that why, there's two ways working with code when you're working in a large group. One is to have like a check-in, check-out, which is like a library book, which is only one person can check out and work on the code at a time. The other one is to work in parallel, which is, okay, I'm going to work on chapter one, and Peter's going to work on chapter nine, and we can both work on those chapters independently, and then we'll come at the end and we'll go, oh, okay, we'll figure out how to make these things work together. But we can work independently and work together. That's what open is about, and all the open source communities have moved, and now they house a lot of their code on GitHub in that open sense. The second part, transactional relationship versus collaborative relationships. If you are in a private sourcing world, you have licensing, you have to control that, you have to, in effect, have a production chain or a supply chain because you're managing all this stuff. We are moving into a relationship where you have alliances that are long-term, they work in a different way. So innovation works differently when there's not a single company controlling everything and you've got multiple people in collaboration. The third one, analytical problem solving. If you have a product and you're trying to get it to market, then you have already decided and can define what that is analytically. The alternative is to have these multidisciplinary conversations, which is to go out and start working with business partners and saying, look, I'm working on this part of the code because it's important to me. What are you working on? Oh, yeah, we put these two things together. And which customer are we going to go and approach together with that technology? The last one is on the economics. And it's a change from colonial trade, in effect, where you have research. And so IBM used to have two research places. One was in two major ones, one in Yorktown and one in San Jose. They had one in, but they've now gone more internationally because talent is now global. So if you think about the way that innovation has changed, if you're in the industrial age, or going back to 1886 and the copyrights, the old way of private, transactional, analytical, and colonial might have worked, but now we're in this new world where we have the internet and things are moving much more quickly. We have open, collaborative, multidisciplinary, and global. Okay, I'm going to skip over descriptive theory building. And go to the normative. Okay, the subtitle of this is Theory Building on Open Sourcing While Private Sourcing. So I've talked to you a little bit about what I used as data, but then the question is, what do you do with it? So normative theory defines what causes the outcome of interest. Because when you are doing descriptive theory allows you to do correlations, and you say that this is related to that. But if you're in business or you're a practical person, you go, okay, that's a nice theory, what can I actually do with it? You're trying to make some intervention or change in the world. And so Clayton Christensen, who wrote The Innovator's Dilemma, has had this interesting sideline of writing things about methodology, because when people come to that innovation, they want to make a choice, they want to do something practical with it. And so they have what's called normative theory, which is what you do with it. So when would you use normative theory? Okay, so in the book I write about three examples where we could use normative theory. One, polycentric governance. We've had this period, this decade go by when globalization has happened. What do we know that can help us on deglobalization? Well, that's not something you can do in science. Science requires data. So until we've had enough deglobalization, we had enough data, we can move on it, we can't really do anything. So you're in normative theory. Second one, Internet of Things. What can we do with the Internet of Things? Well, if we had it before, we'd have a science. We don't have it. So normative theory comes into play. The third one, cognitive computing, or as Jim Spohr calls it, intelligence augmentation. All these new technologies are coming in. What do we have in science? You can't rely on science on it. We don't have enough data. And so we can't take the descriptive approach that we normally do. We're going to take a normative approach. So the way that I've done this, and this is starting to get into some of the system stuff, is we have a paradigm and we have theories within the paradigm. A paradigm is a collection of methods or ideas that form a scientific theory. And for those who've done Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn, every PhD student is probably Thomas Kuhn, the Structure of Scientific Revolutions. The way I've been approaching this is to look at multiple paradigms. The paradigm that I've fallen into is what I call co-responsive movement. And co-responsive movement comes from ecological anthropology. And the idea behind ecological anthropology is we have multiple people that are multiple things or multiple people that are moving simultaneously. So as opposed to a static world in science where you can actually hold one thing fixed and move everything else around it, in ecological anthropology they say, no, everything moves. Everything's moving simultaneously and you've got to deal with that. And what you need to do is get a grip on the larger world that contains that. The other part that's part of co-responsive movement and the change of philosophy is we have a shift towards material culture studies. And for those of you who are into constructivism or in effect, the question is, what is real? In some philosophies, if everyone believes it's true, it's true. In this case, we go to material cultural studies. There's been this turn in the material world, which is, well, no, actually there's some reality. So if someone's building something, it doesn't matter if they're talking about it, I want to see it built. This is particularly prevalent if you start looking at open source communities, because people talk about the plans of software or products they're going to build, and no one believes them. It's all vaporware. We want to see something built. When we can see it's built, we can judge and then say it's good or it's bad, but you can only do that if there's something material associated with it. So there are three theories. The first theory is innovation learning four, and we're saying innovation learning four, and I'll explain each one of these three in more detail in the slides to follow. Innovation learning four is about instilling intentionality. So remember I was saying that everything is moving simultaneously? So what you're looking for is attention. You're trying to get people focused on the right thing and you want their skills to be focused on that. So we're talking about Internet of Things. Well, what do you focus on the Internet of Things or blockchain? What do you focus on a blockchain? It's like there are parts of blockchain that have nothing to do with money. I think that's a really good technology focused on. But that's being attentional and focusing on that. This is related, the innovation learning four is related to episteme, which is a know why, which tends to be the traditional scientific pursuit. The theory building, the second one on innovation learning by, is weaving flows through form giving. Techne is a know how. And what happens with this theory is that innovation learning happens while you're working on something material. So the idea of weaving is pretty interesting because it's not like, again, you have something that's static, a block of marble or whatever you're trying to chip away at. You're trying to weave things through it. And the third one of innovation and learning alongside is what agency strands. So each one of us, if we're on our lifelines, there's a strand and a lifeline we leave behind us, and we each put agency behind it. We can have decisions and we can have authority over what we want to do. And this impacts phronesis, which is what I call know whom, know when, and know where in the contextual types of science. So let me cover each one of those briefly. So innovation learning four, there are three types of learning four. There's proto-learning, deutero-learning, and trito-learning. Proto-learning, in effect, the story that I'm going to tell about this associated with Gregory Bateson, who is looking at dolphins and how dolphins learn. So you have the dolphin that has zero learning, which I don't have on the chart, zero learning. You try to teach the dolphin a trick, it doesn't learn the trick. Proto-learning is you can teach the dolphin to do one trick. And it does it consistently and it does it well. The second example, deutero-learning. Deutero-learning is the case where you reward the dolphin not for doing the same trick over, but you reward the dolphin for doing new tricks. This is increasing the set or sequence of alternatives in a change. So what happens is that when you're doing deutero learning, there are more options available as opposed to in the proto learning, you're doing one thing over and over again. Trito learning is if you're in a different environment. This would be taking a dolphin that's been in the tank for 10 years, taking it out of the tank and putting them in the ocean. Can they do tricks in the ocean? And when you're working on innovation, if things are moving, then you have this idea of trito learning becomes important. Now, if we look at the types of innovation learning that happen, you need to do all three of these things, but the question is, what's the balance? How much are you going to spend on trying to get one thing right? How much are you going to spend on trying to expand that range? And then how much are you going to spend after that getting out into a completely different environment? The second one, a co-responsive movement. There's three ideas: learning by doing, learning by making, and learning by trying. Learning by doing, if you actually look at the original literature, was based off aircraft manufacturing. Essentially, the idea was the experience curve. The more aircraft you build, the cheaper it gets because you have more experience building more aircraft. But that's more or less doing the same thing over and over again. You're accumulating experiences, and you can do that both in organizational and personal sense. Learning by making is a little bit different because, in this case, you can't just build a machine. Now, we talk about the weaving, we talk about materials. Baking is a good example of learning by making that never quite understood. My understanding is that if you're a good baker, you have to figure out what the humidity is that day, and you have to change your recipe. And how are you going to learn that? Learning by making is you make things, and then you make them again, and you get the experience of working hands-on with something, and there's a materiality associated with it. The third one, learning by trying. Learning by trying makes failure acceptable. If you are in the open innovation mode and you can go download software for free, is it any good? And so the challenge I take, and whenever I get new technology, new software, it's available for free. I don't know anything about it. I download it and I run it. I set a clock. In 1 hour, can I make the software work? If I can't make it work in an hour, like if I make zero progress, either I'm really dumb or the software is really stupid. Like one or the other. I'm not sure what it is. But the only way I'm going to find out is learning by trying. And I will fail, and if I fail, I've learned something, which is maybe I didn't know that programming language, maybe I don't like the technology, I don't know what they're thinking, whatever. But again, if we look at these three ways, learning by doing, learning by making, learning by trying, they're all a balance of those sort of things that happen in innovation learning. The last one is interesting. It's learning alongside as things are moving. So these are interesting balances. So there's a balancing of polyrhythmia and eurythmia. So the way I describe this is eurythmia, rhythm, there's an interesting, I like this one article which has been published, it's called Why Philosophers Have No Rhythm. And it's because philosophy has not studied rhythm. They study harmony a lot, but they don't study rhythm. Rhythm is something that is human, and it is a feel. So if you're listening to drummers, I don't know how many of you like drummers, getting in the groove with the drummer, they're not like a metronome, they swing. And you get this idea coming behind of rhythm. In the first time I wrote chapter 9, I was tired of writing it, and so polyrhythmia, entangling eurythmia, I end up writing a whole chapter on the rock band The Police. Because how is it you actually play reggae and punk together? And so my friend Don is here. We've actually done this. If you get any musicians, actually try to play The Police. It is the most difficult music to play. The Police, after not being together for almost 20 years, went on tour. But before they did that, they have 5 months of rehearsal. 5 months of rehearsal to learn the music that they wrote. So it's really good. There's a good DVD of the whole Police tour, and it's called the Better Than Therapy tour. Because the polyrhythmia, the idea that you would have things that are not working together, like you have reggae and you have punk beats going together, you have the drum on the beat, you have the bass behind the beat, you have the guitar ahead of the beat, is very, very difficult. The second one, regenerating, entangling, preserving. This came up through anthropology. There's and this actually gave me a new light on sustainability. So Anthony's going to want to look up the article on this, on the second life of trees. The second life of trees is a story about upland Japan, where they have forestry, And the idea is that there are two lives of the tree. There's the first 30 years of a tree when the family takes care of the tree, and then the next 30 years is the tree takes care of you, because you cut it down and you make it into a house. That's the way the philosophy has worked. And so sustainability does not mean preserving. Sustainability means lining up the rhythms so that regeneration happens. And so every once in a while, someone needs a really big tree that more than 30 years old to be cut down. They go to the special part of the forest, they have a special ritual to get permission from their ancestors to cut down the tree, they take down the tree, and it becomes the main pillar for a house. That's the sort of thing that happens. And so this idea in sustainability on a continuity of living nature, which is like a tree that is like wheat, except it grows a lot slower, versus the form. There's this idea about trees being dead on their legs as they get old. The third one is less leading to more, entangling more leading to more. And the gun crisis, a lot of this comes from Ian Mitroff's work, and he was looking at nuclear proliferation, but also happens with the gun problem we have in the United States. So is the solution to guns more guns? That is more leading to more. How is it you would go as an alternative to that? Well, you need less leading to more. Well, how is it you get there? Well, there's a struggle between less leading to more and more leading to more that happens. And you end up with that. And in systems theory, you end up with complexity versus complicatedness. So those are the three theories. And the philosophy that's behind all this is, so typically when we talk about business, we end up in teleology. We talk about goals, objectives, ideals, these sorts of things, a whole branch of philosophy. When you start looking at things as an evolutionary perspective, you end up in teleonomy, which is about environmental change, somatic change with a cellular change, and genotypical change. So you're looking at change where change is programmed in. So as opposed to thinking about goals where you have an endpoint and you're trying to get to that endpoint, teleonomy looks at it from a biological perspective and says, you can't get there from here until you take the first step and then the second step and the third step. So as opposed to going out and then working back, what happens if we move forward? If we start looking at open source communities and the way they work, they all work on that way. All the code is available for free and you can move forward step by step. And this allows you to get into the ecosystem research on alternative stable states. It's not just one equilibrium. There's actually multiple equilibria. So this brings me to the last point about systems thinking. And there's this idea I found. Stable equilibrium is death. For those of you who study economics or believe that we should always equilibrium, this is a really bad idea. This comes from a very, very old publication. Adams was published in 1910. And he talks about the only system that is an equilibrium is a system that is dead. And so if you're looking at innovation learning, it's not just about innovation that is a static thing. You're looking at learning that happens over a period of time. This is also related to Stephen Jay Gould's book on that talks about punctuated equilibrium. And so you have equilibrium at certain points and movement over time. But in effect, you have the idea that you have this movement over time where things are not in equilibrium. So to finish off, my question is your theory, which are theory building, generative in a systems sense? And there's kind of systematic approaches and there's systemic approaches. So in a systematic approach, we have what's called somatic change, which is adaptive or cellular change. In genotypic change, we have generational change that's different. So there's things I can do that I can do for my own body. There's things like pass along to my children that some of them I see, some of my features, some of my spouse's features, and they end up in genes. We end up with a distinction between non-living and living systems. This idea about allopoiesis. Allopoiesis is a term that is like a production line where you have a factory, and off the end of the line, you've got something created that is so you have robots, and they create something that's not a robot. In a living, a system generating system, you have the idea of autopoiesis. Autopoietic system is self-generating, so biology is self-generating. In a systematic approach, you tend to be reactive because you can see where the world has changed, and from that you can make a response. But in a world that's systemic, everything has changed and you need to be co-responsive. And that's the book. And it is a lot simpler than reading it. Thank you.
Would you moderate, Peter? For
Are you going to have a bit of a panel, or do you want to run into questions? So,
Steven and